Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. We've got a whopper of a show this week when we speak to Benedict Cumberbatch about his new Netflix series, Eric, about a parent looking for a missing child who's being haunted by a giant puppet. I talk to acting legend Matthew Modine about his new movie Hard Miles, about a group of troubled teens cycling through the Grand Canyon. And he also chats about working with Stanley Kubrick on Full Metal Jacket. And as if all that weren't enough, I chat with Richard Linklater about his new movie Hitman, where a philosophy lecturer doubles up as a fake hitman. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well. Now, I'm going to dispense with my normal, you know, banter, where I begin with most weeks, telling you something, you know, slightly inane from the week that happened to me or huge in my world, just because there was an awful lot to get through on the show this week and an awful lot of good stuff. So let me begin with TV.
Tell your mom what you're working on, kid.
His name is Eric.
Missing persons, Detective LaDroid.
Mark up every door you've knocked on, every area you've searched.
Mr. Anderson, do you have any comment?
Press are crazier with this.
Do you even have a suspect?
We're ruling nothing out.
They're saying that if he was alive, that you would have found him by now.
You have to trust me.
What are you doing with Edgar's drawings?
I'm working on a new puppet. If we can get him on the show, then Edgar will see him. He'll know how much we want him to come home.
You're going crazy.
Now, that is a clip from Eric, which landed this week on Netflix, the 28th of May, to be precise, which I believe was Tuesday, but I'm terrible with dates. But as at the time of listening to this show, it is up there for your viewing pleasure, all six episodes. And in it, we have Benedict Cumberbatch playing a famous puppeteer called Vincent, who's created this show called Goodbye Sunshine, and his nine-year-old son Edgar goes missing. Now, before he goes missing, we see that he has a pretty difficult, strained relationship with his wife, played by the great Gabby Hoffman, who a lot of people will know from Girls. And he's drinking too much. This is Benedict Cumberbatch's character, Vincent. And it begins as a kind of child going missing case and what's going to happen. But Vincent is falling apart and he's drinking too much. And he comes up with the idea that he's going to create a puppet called Eric that Edgar is going to see on TV and come home. And what happens then is that this character, Eric, comes to life and this giant puppet visits Benedict Cumberbatch and only he can see him and kind of gives out to him, but also maybe tries to help him. It's fascinating stuff. Now, all the while this is taking place in a very grimy 1980s, 1985, 1986 New York, where we have a lot of homophobia, racism, the AIDS epidemic. There is another missing child from not so long ago, an African-American child who may be related to the other missing child, Benedict Cumberbatch's son. And the detective looking after this, Michael LaDrotte is his name, is played by an actor called McKinley Belchar III, unusually named, who plays a black cop who's also a closeted gay who's caring for his partner who's dying of AIDS. And he's trying to piece together this case. This is a great show. Benedict Cumberbatch is in terrific form here. So I got to talk to Benedict Cumberbatch about playing this troubled puppeteer missing, searching for his missing son, as well as Gabby Hoffman, who plays his wife, Cassie, in this. Gabby Hoffman started life as a child actress and was in things like Uncle Buck and left for a while and then came back and has been in all sorts of things like Girls, that famous show. She was even in Field of Dreams and Sleepless in Seattle when she was younger. So I spoke to Gabby Hoffman and Benedict Cumberbatch about their new series, Eric, on Netflix. And I should mention, they were both slightly jet-lagged and I shared with them that I was tired as well, because the day we recorded this, it was the day after I'd taken my 11-year-old to Bruce Springsteen. So we do begin discussing that, but we move to Eric.
Yes. Hi, guys. How are you?
Neck rolls. Hello. We're just loosening up our necks.
Yeah, we've been sat this way around, and I can't speak for myself because I'm not as jet-lagged, but Gabby is jet-lagged, and can't speak for myself. There's a mansplainer.
It was great for radio, you moving your neck. You know, that'll really work well on the radio.
Keep up my bones.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to overshare and tell you I'm really tired because I took my 11-year-old to Bruce Springsteen last night.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
There's three of us tired. Dublin and Pro Park. So, so we're all tired, but it's great to see you.
How was he? How was the boss?
Brilliant as always. And you know what? Netflix won't be happy about us spending time talking about Springsteen, but you get to that age of your life and you're still able to do it at 74. There's just something almost religious about a man like that who's so powerful. It was just great. It was great.
I agree.
I'm wasting our precious time.
No,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, never wasting talking about it. Yeah.
Benedict, if I can start with you, you know, it seems to me that having this puppet, Eric, you know, is almost, I'm sure there's challenges talking to this thing, whatever it is, but it must be a gift as an actor and even as a person nearly to have this, like your id or this unconscious underbelly to play against during this trauma you're going through.
Absolutely. And on the page, it was like, what? How is that going to be? What is that difficult? Or how? And in reality, you're absolutely right. And it, both in terms of storytelling, but also performance, it's this immediate dialogue with the self, you know, and it was more about how to manifest moments of his transition through this dark odyssey into some kind of growth by the end, in more subtle ways when Eric's not around. And Eric is a very immediate, you know, he pinpoints truths in authenticity. He's both a nursemaid and an enabler. He's an aggressor and a friend. He's all of these things bubbling up at any one time. Those kind of internal struggles we have with identifying who we are at any given moment, our choices and all the kind of voices we have in our heads, but made to, you know, to a very large externalized extreme. And to have something literally to push against is dramatically, I guess, a lot easier than sometimes than containing it. However, it's screen acting, and that's also a gorgeous thing. I think the LaDroite character, the amount of repression that McKinley so brilliantly portrays, is also a gift for an actor because the camera reads you, and it gets to follow you into apartments and see your privacy or your many masks and many selves play out. So both are delightful and equal in Abby Morgan's hands and Lucy's.
Yeah.
So I hear what you're saying, and it's a very, very good point.
Good. Gabby, you know, in terms of finding the place to go, you're a parent, Benedict's a parent, I'm a parent. It must be, you know, I'm not saying easy, but the access of those emotions, you know, it's nightmare 101 for any parent, a child going missing. So I just wonder, are you straight in it? I'm not saying you don't have to do any preparation, but the emotional heft, you probably get it straight away.
Yeah. I mean, there's a little bit that goes into it.
Just
step in on a daily basis. But yes, I have found that since becoming a parent, I have a much greater access to the entirety of the human emotional landscape. And to me, children are bringing, the grace of God and all that entails into your life on a daily basis. And if I can bring a little bit of that into my work, it does make it not only easier, but a lot more enjoyable because I'm here to sort of live in that soup wherever I can.
So, yeah.
That I would have been able to do this prior to becoming a mother.
Yeah. You lived in the soup very well. You know, Benedict, we were talking about Bruce Springsteen, and he said this great thing that musicians, it's a long line of people going, "Daddy," and it's similar with a lot of actors. Yeah. And I read in the Sunday Times only yesterday, and I don't mean to personalize it up too much, but your father was an actor, and he was so, and still is so beautifully proud of you. And so many actors seem to have complicated relationships with their dads, male and female, and mothers as well, because it's a great psychic drama. Like, are you very pleased about the fact that your dad as an actor was so proud of you and still seems to be? That seems to be another gift.
Yeah, I mean, there's the child part in me that wants to make them proud. It's a large motivation, if nothing else. Maybe less to do with, like, finally I'll get their attention. I always had their attention. I was very spoiled in that regard as an only child, than just by landing with incredibly loving human beings. But also, you know, yeah, they put so much time and effort in. And again, going back to being a parent yourself, the sort of the deeper drop of empathy and love and understanding for the thing you've rebelled against or moved away from, all the kind of pushing apart to find yourself as a child from your parent just disappears. You suddenly have utter empathy and linkage with them. You go, my God, they went through this. They held me as a little vulnerable life form just at the beginning of it all and gave me everything to get me here as now a dad. You know, that cyclical thing is extraordinary. So within the work itself, I strive to make dad happy and proud, or confused or angry or amused, all of the reactors. But, you know, it is, I'm very lucky. I'm very, very lucky. And they're enormously generous in their love of me. I can do no wrong in many ways. So they're not my sternest critic, but they are people that I really, really enjoy making happy.
Love it. We're out of time. I spoke to you for The Power of the Dog 3 years ago, and I think it's a travesty you didn't win an Oscar for that. So I'll say that in closing, if that's okay. Lovely to see you both, guys.
Thank you.
Benedict Cumberbatch there, and me saying he should have won for Power of the Dog a couple of years ago. Will Smith won for King Richard, but Benedict deserved that. But he was talking to me, as was Gabby Hoffman, about their new series on Netflix, which is called Eric, which is very, very good. Now, staying with Eric, it was written by a lady called Abby Morgan, who gave us the script, who wrote The Iron Lady. She also wrote a great TV show, The Split. And she was really keen to kind of set this in the 1980s. So I got to talk to her and also the actor I mentioned earlier in the show who plays the detective, Michael Ledroit, who's attempting to solve this and another missing child case, played by the unusually named McKinley Belshar III, who has been in Ozark, A Marriage Story from a few years ago. He was also on Broadway in Death of a Salesman when he got the call for this show. So I spoke to Abby Morgan and McKinley Belshar III also about the great series Eric.
Abby, if I can start with you, I was 10 in 1985 or 1986, yet so much of what I think about New York and even American cinema comes from kind of that grimy New York time of like Taxi Driver and Mean Streets. And it seems to me that in the writing of this, you were really keen to make it that grimy kind of New York that we know and somewhat love. Or
I was I wish I was 10 in the mid-80s. I was 18 in the mid-80s, and when I first came, I stayed in a hostel in Times Square, and then that was grimy, that was alive, that was buzzing, it was really exciting. I remember it was an incredibly hot summer, and it felt like all of life was out there. And I, you know, growing up in the 80s in Stoke-on-Trent and then Newcastle-upon-Tyne, and then I grew up everywhere, but there was still this resonant fear of the 80s, I remember. There was like the AIDS epidemic felt like terrifying, you know, there was such a weaponization of homosexuality at the time. And then of course all those issues of institutionalized racism and gentrification, they were incredibly resonant to me. But also I saw that in the city in the early mid 80s when I was out there, and just I was kind of drawn to it, like you say, by the so much of the TV and film I'd grown up with and loved. You know, in many ways the show is a homage also to Kramer versus Kramer, which was a beautiful city where you know, the city New York has a real role in that, but also it's about a marriage falling apart. That was also what I was looking at, was this kind of calcifying, toxifying relationship within this apartment that was happening, seen through the eyes of this little boy who then escapes into the city in a way to get away from it. And then in that quest to find his son, we realized that actually this is also an interrogation of the city at that time as much as the man himself. So many things.
The Kramer versus Kramer thing, I hadn't thought about that, but I see it blindingly now. McKinley, you know, you play an African-American gay cop caring for his sick partner or other half. I mean, this is a very meaty role. I assume you get it and you go, there's so many things going on here. This is a character who's hiding his true self because he has to. Like, I imagine it's kind of the meat and potatoes for an actor when you get a script like this.
Absolutely. And that was apparent from just my first read of a couple scenes and maybe the first episode or two, that the show was interested in him, not just in terms of his role in the investigation, but that I would get the opportunity to play a whole human and get to bring my whole heart to all of the things that he's managing. And what you're talking about with this relationship that he's found with William, it's thrilling to think that how much freedom you would have in the apartment alone, where you get to just be, and there's this love that is special that few people have the opportunity to experience in life, and what it would be to have that at home in this safe bubble, and to walk out into the world and be confronted with such hostility and this very real need to manage public and private self, to compartmentalize your life as a safeguard. He was living at a time where it was not safe to be a queer man in the NYPD.
So to
manage all of that and to understand it as fuel for why he's the perfect person to be managing this investigation, and to be going and be gifted with a real journey in terms of like a man stepping fully into himself, and able to offer something not only to this investigation but to the world and changing the NYPD in the end, is thrilling.
Yeah. And Abby, I was talking to Gabby and Benedict beforehand, and we were talking about, you know, parenthood. I have children, and I was telling them I took my 11-year-old to Bruce Springsteen last night because Benedict was apologizing for being tired, and so was I. But anyway, that's it. And I don't know why I'm telling you that. But what I like about the parenthood thing is you have these parents who are, you know, it's nightmare 101 for any parent that a child goes missing. And yet sometimes in those dramas, it's the parents are these perfect people, and yet they're very damaged in your show. They're really complicated people, and particularly Benedict. I don't want to give any kind of spoilers, but there's suspicions about who he is as a parent and as a man. Were you keen to just make it like, this is the way parenting is? Sometimes, or a lot of the time, we screw up, and I know that we screw up as a parent.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's so key at the heart of it, is that it's about the imperfection of being a parent that you're always juggling with, and nobody is a perfect parent, and certainly this is a toxic, calcifying relationship, but fundamentally the disappearance of their child is what exposes it to themselves and makes them have to face themselves. And I guess that's the bigger metaphor, which is the disappearance of any child makes one not ask, are we looking after a child in a city? And that there are different kinds of parents. There are the parental role of the government, there's the parental role of cops, there's the parental role of just the neighbor or the friend who saw the child that day. And I'm playing with the kind of ricochet of responsibility as well, so that, you know, and then the idea that, you know, we're all children at the heart. You know, it's not just the adult part of ourselves that parent our children, it's the child part as well. And you have to get to know that child part of yourself. And I think that's one of the great joys of having a child, is that sometimes you're confronted with your own child, you know. And
I'm playing with that idea of
the joy of, like, you know, being a kid again and taking your kid to see Bruce Springsteen. You know, that sometimes there's a pleasure for your children to see your kid, and sometimes you don't want your kid to see that kid. You want that kid to grow up, you know.
Absolutely. He saw my inner kid when I was complaining about the price of burgers anyway, McKinley, I was reading about you, and you get these rave reviews for your role in Death of a Salesman on Broadway. And I haven't seen it because I don't live in New York, but it sounds like you did a terrific job. But I, you know, those Broadway shows are very hard work. Sometimes you're doing two shows a day and all. But I gather in the production notes that you were so busy with that, when this came on your desk, you had to do an audition tape for it in an intermission. God bless you. Is that true?
It's half true. I definitely was on the phone with my agent during intermission.
And
they were like, well, this is a tape that we need it tomorrow. And because the show is 3 hours, I didn't get home until midnight that night. So the next morning, I sort of tackled the tape. I was learning the lines during intermission.
Wow.
So it was a very quick turnaround. And then that next week is when I met Abby and Lucy on Zoom.
It's a very, very, very good audition tape. So for any actor listening now, that's the way to do it. Like, do it first thing the next morning, because it was really good.
Grace under pressure, or something like that, as they call it. Well, listen, Eric is terrific. So congratulations, guys, and continued success.
Thank you
so much. Much appreciated.
Cheers.
Abby Morgan, the writer and creator of Eric on Netflix, and also McKinley Belcher III, there talking to me about his role in Eric. He plays the lead detective, and he's brilliant in it as this guy who's hiding a lot of things from the world, most notably the fact that he's gay and living with someone who's very ill. Anyway, so that's Eric on Netflix. All six episodes are there. A great watch. And I always tell you this, my wife, who watches most of this stuff with me, loved it as well. And we had that. Let's watch another one. We'll squeeze in half an episode before we go to bed. So there you go. That was Eric on Netflix and Benedict Cumberbatch and the gang. Now the stars keep coming, because after the break, I'll be talking to the great Matthew Modine about his new cycling movie. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time. Opening this weekend, on the 31st of May, in fact, is Hard Miles. It tells the uplifting true story of a bicycling team at Ridgeview Academy, a medium security correctional school in Colorado. The film follows beleaguered coach Greg Townsend. This is a true story. And in it, Greg Townsend is played by the great Matthew Modine, as he rounds up an unlikely crew of incarcerated students for a seemingly impossible bike ride from Denver to the Grand Canyon. And as I say, this is a true story. 752 miles was the length of the cycle. And it turns out, he's very much alive, this guy Greg Townsend regularly took students, over 1,000 of them, on long bike rides in a bid to help them, in essence. And the particular gang in this group are very troubled. There's four of them. They're gangbangers, as you might say. One of them has an eating disorder. And Matthew Modine, playing Greg Townsend, gets them to build bikes in this correction facility and then go on this long, long cycle. It's a real good sports drama and kind of uplifting, you know, and it really makes you want to cycle your bike. Now, Matthew Modine is a legend, I suppose. He first came to prominence in Full Metal Jacket, where he's been in everything since then, like Vision Quest, that famous movie, Married to the Mob, Oppenheimer from last year. He was in The Dark Knight Rises. Most recently, a lot of people rediscovered him, I suppose, when he played Dr. Martin Brenner in Netflix's Stranger Things. He's also a huge cyclist and a big bike enthusiast, as you'll hear in my chat with him now, because I had a talk with him about Hard Miles and his long career from his Greenwich Village apartment earlier this week. So Matthew, it seems to me that this movie was almost made for you in terms of your passions. People may know you're a big cyclist, and it has part of the genesis of your career involved a bicycle. And also personally, you had a relation who was in a reform school when he was a teenager. So, I mean, you must have got this script and thought, man, this is one for me. But I mean, you tell me.
Well, I certainly understood it. You know, my bicycling began just because I was on the corner of 42nd Street and Lexington Avenue in New York City selling lemonade. And a guy rode up on a bicycle, threw it on the ground and ran. And clearly he'd stolen the bicycle. I don't know why he dumped it and just didn't carry on down the road, but he dumped it. And I had about 3 gallons of lemonade I had to get through to, you know, selling to the commuters. And I leaned the bicycle against the wall and I said, if the fella doesn't come back, I'll have to adopt that bicycle. So I used that bicycle to get around New York City for the next 15 years. And because I was poor, you know, it was difficult to even purchase a subway token. And so that bicycle was able to get me, you know, instead of 2 auditions a day or 3 auditions, I could do 5 or 6 because I could get around the city. It became my gymnasium. And then it grew into, somebody asked me if there was something I could do to reduce my carbon footprint, what would it be? And I said, well, ride a bicycle. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, you know, choosing to ride a bicycle in a city like New York City, yeah, or Dublin or London has an immediate positive impact on the environment. You're reducing your carbon footprint. And that evolved into something called Bicycle for a Day. And it helped to usher in the bike share program in New York City called City Bike, the bicycle lanes and safe routes to school for children. And then, as you mentioned, my brother Russell ended up in a reform school in Salt Lake City, Utah. And so I would go with my mother. I'm the youngest of 7 children. I would go with my mom to visit him. And, you know, it's such a strange, hostile environment. And so I understood that aspect of this story. And then because the story is based on a true story of this fellow, Greg Townsend, who teaches kids how to weld and then taught them how to weld bicycles. And he felt that if he could teach them to build something that they would be proud of and then take them on a difficult ride, an arduous ride from Denver, Colorado to the Grand Canyon, that he'd be able to help them see that the world was bigger than the violent home that they came from or the drugs or the gang that they were in. Mm-hmm. And so that rehabilitation is, for me, one of the most important things that we can do for our youth, because it's just a pocket of a period of time that young people get in trouble. Like, I guess it's probably 15 to 18, 19 years old, where boys just do stupid things. And I would say that if you didn't, it's only because, you know, you didn't get caught doing it. Because I certainly didn't get caught. I did a lot of stupid things when I was a young boy. And I just know how important it is not to give up on them and not punish them for their entire lives for doing something stupid during those stupid, difficult years that boys go through.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, one of the feelings I had watching the film was, like, obviously there's a metaphor, but you guys go on this journey as well. Like, you see you cycling these hundreds of miles, but it's kind of like a call to the wild or a call of the wild. I felt like getting my bike out of the shed and going cycling, you know, and my form of exercise is running, not to bore you, but I do have a bike in the shed. And when you were out in those hills in that desert, I thought, I got to get my bike tuned up. So I know the movie's about, you know, what happens to people when they're young and how it's so important to treat them well and it's good for us all. But is part of the mission of the film maybe a clarion call to get people on their bikes as well? Because I had that feeling watching it.
Well, I think that after, you know, the pandemic, everybody going through that and feeling isolated and separate from nature, that it's exhilarating to watch the film because it's, as you say, it's all outdoors and the world is so big that we forget about those things. And I mean, it's so beautiful to go for hikes in Ireland, you know, or go up into the Scottish Highlands and things like that. And, you know, it's that, I don't know who said it, that sometimes we have to get lost to find ourselves. Mm. And I think that's so important, you know, rather than just sitting in front of the telly or getting our news from social media and such, that how important it is to sort of unplug and go and experience, feel a cold breeze, a bracing breeze in your face, or go jump in a really cold sea.
Yeah, we've lots of them here. Yeah. Tell me this, you play this guy, Greg Townsend, and he seems like a fascinating guy. In the movie, your character and Greg, he's having his own struggles, and I don't want to give any kind of spoiler, but he's a difficult relationship, to put it mildly, with his father, who's ill. And it's, I really like the kind of dichotomy of him trying to help these younger people and yet being very conflicted, justifiably so, about his relationship with his father. Was that true of Greg's life, or was that something just found its way into the script?
No, it was an important part of the story for the real Greg Townsend, because what he realized, he didn't realize it until his father passed, that what he was trying to fix in those young men was actually something that was broken in himself. So he didn't realize it till his father passed, that what he was trying to fix was his own broken childhood.
Yeah. The wounded healer, maybe, or something like that. Yeah. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous film. Has Greg given you a sense of what he makes of it all?
Oh, he loves the film. I think it's difficult and you know, imagine somebody making a movie about your life and warts and pimples and all. I think that there are aspects of it that are uncomfortable to him. But the fact of the matter is, Greg Townsend has taken thousands of young people on bike rides now across the United States, you know, to different locations. And the success rate is about 90% of of taking these troubled youth and helping them to live productive lives. An important thing that happened in America, I don't know what it is in Ireland, but they privatized the prisons in the United States. They used to be called penitentiaries, and somewhere along the way they started calling them prisons, and people could franchise them like a I don't know, Kentucky Fried Chicken or something, a McDonald's, and they became private businesses. And so when those prisons were owned by private individuals, they wanted to cut back on things that would help to rehabilitate and educate and teach people trades, because all that costs money. So prisons are just places where you lock people up and feed them. So the root of penitentiary is penance, and it was, you know, that you make a mistake and that you do the time for the crime, but ideally you would have learned something while you were in there so that you come out and live a more productive life. And that's gone from the American prison system in America, maybe just because of the change of that word. We don't change words unless there's a reason, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Our prison system, you know, I'm not that qualified, but it's certainly not privatized, which seems to be a good thing. Listen, I don't want to monopolize all your time because I know there's a couple of people waiting, but if I could just ask you two more things outside of the movie. Full Metal Jacket is the first thing I ever saw you in. And I actually have a copy somewhere. I couldn't find it this morning when I went to look for it, but I was given a present, Walt, of Full Metal Jacket Diary, the book you made. That was your diary and the photographs of your time there. But it was kind of the guts of 20 years until you released it. And I was wondering, was it such a shock to be doing that at the time, you know, and Kubrick, God rest him, was an unusual but fascinating guy. Like, I'm wondering, why did you wait 20 years? Was there reasons, or was it just it took a while to get around to it?
Well, I always wanted to do something with photographs, and then I finally met a publisher who said he'd like to publish the photographs, and he said, you know, you'll have to tell a story about the photographs. You'll have to caption them. Mm. And I said, well, I kept a diary while I was making the film, and he said, are you comfortable transcribing it? So I transcribed the diary, and I realized that there was something really valuable in here, because it wasn't me genuflecting on the experience of the film 20 years later. It was, or 15, I don't remember. I guess it was 20 years. Yeah, I didn't think of it. But it's the voice of a 25-year-old young man who didn't have any world experience. Like, you know, it was my first time to England where we filmed, first time working with someone as extraordinary as Stanley Kubrick. All the things that were happening in the film. Chernobyl happened then. My father had a heart attack. My manager died. My son was born. There were so many things happening. And while I was making this film with Stanley Kubrick for almost 2 years of my life, for anybody that's really curious about Stanley Kubrick or the process of making film, I think it's a fascinating peek behind the curtain. And it's raw. And it's, as I say, it's not me. If I wrote about my experience with Stanley today, it would be, it would be flowery, and the edges would be gone. But yeah. Because it's that 25-year-old boy writing the story, it's vulnerable and raw, let's say.
For your
listeners that don't have access to the book, it is an iPad app. If you can get an iPad, I think it's a 99 cents or $1.99. Okay. Yeah, and there's more photographs in the iPad app than in the book.
Okay, that's good to know.
And you can listen to it. I narrate it, and there's sound effects and music.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, I have to check that. And then finally, because the nice people have organized this interview, and I try not to run over on these things, to repay them for their kindness of letting me talk to Matthew Modine, live from New York. But listen, you know, you've had a huge amount of success and fame and all that kind of stuff. But I'm wondering, the Stranger Things phenomena, has that been odd that you were in this thing that was, like, you were in lots of things that were huge, but in the era of Netflix and things like that, Stranger Things has this life now, and it's big with teenagers and stuff like that. Have you found that strange that now teenagers might come up to you and go, you're the guy from Stranger Things?
Yeah. But it's good. You know, I mean, I've been in this business for 4 decades now.
Yeah.
And you know, what you're always up against is remaining relevant, remaining part of the conversation.
Yeah.
So when you become part of something that, I mean, in the case of Netflix, is a global phenomenon, you just have to be grateful and thankful that you were a part, you know, that they asked you to be a part of something that became so successful. When Full Metal Jacket came out at that time, let's say 1985, 86, if you had a show that was successful in 30 countries around the world, 30 territories, that was a huge success. Netflix is in over 182, 190 yeah. some territories. So the children of the show, like my friend Millie Bobby Brown,
yeah.
became famous in a way that's never existed in the history of the entertainment industry. That never happened before. Even, you know, I mean, the biggest stars in the world, Elvis Presley, the Beatles, the speed of success and the notoriety and the, you know, the way that people recognize you, that never has happened in the history of the entertainment industry. So I'm just really happy that they asked me to be a part of it. And I said yes.
Yeah, well, they got something out of it too. Well, listen, as we say in this part of the country, get on your bike. Hard Miles is a fantastic film, and I'll be urging people to watch it. Lovely to talk to you, Matthew. Thanks a million.
Thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you.
You think I don't know what's going on inside your head? Huh? Right now you feel helpless. You think this is all pointless. You think this is all a big joke. You want to get in the van? Go ahead. It's right there. You can limp across the road right now, and none of this will have mattered. Or you could set a goal. You can set a goal today and know that nobody told you what you could or couldn't be.
A clip there from Hard Miles, which is in cinemas on the 31st of May. And you heard me talking to its star, Matthew Modine. And lovely to chat to Matthew about all he's seen and done in his long years. Up next, Richard Linklater on his new film, Hitman. Now, you're welcome back to the last part of Screen Time. Now, take a listen to this.
Congrats, Gary. You just got promoted to contract killer.
Well, when do you reschedule? He's not even here yet.
Hitmen don't cancel the first meeting.
Hitmen? Hitmen don't exist. What are we following made-up rules now?
You've seen this a million times. You can do it.
Why don't you do it?
No way. Tried years ago. Almost got killed.
I don't want to almost get killed either. Okay. I'm a civilian.
We got your back. We'll move in if it starts getting pear-shaped.
Clock's ticking. I need you to grab Jasper's wire.
And you might want to check this out real quick. That is everything we know so far, Billy.
What?
Your alias. Billy, let's go.
Oh my God, I'm gonna die.
That is a clip from Hitman, the new Richard Linklater neo-noir, let's call it, comedy thriller, landing on Netflix next Friday, the 7th of June. It got a small cinema release. As I say, it's from Richard Linklater, and it stars Glenn Powell as a straight-laced kind of philosophy professor who moonlights as a fake hitman for the New Orleans Police Department. He's kind of gifted at inhabiting different guises, so they figure out he might be actually quite good to catch hapless people hoping to bump off their enemies and hiring a hitman. Glenn Powell plays Gary, and Gary descends kind of into a morally dubious territory when he finds himself attracted to one of those potential criminals, a beautiful young woman named Madison, played by Adria Ajorna. As Madison falls for one of Gary's hitmen personas, the mysteriously sexy Ron, their steamy affair sets off a chain reaction of play-acting, deception, and escalating stakes. Now, it was co-written by Linklater and Powell and inspired by a true story that Linklater found in Texas Monthly. So I really like this. It's a kind of twisty comedy, sexy thriller, very entertaining. As I say, it's from Richard Linklater, who gave us everything from Slackers, Dazed and Confused, the Before trilogy of Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Before Midnight, School of Rock, Boyhood, brilliant film with Ethan Hawke. So I had a chat with Richard Linklater about Hitman. Tell me this, you know, this is a comedy. And
absolutely. But
there's a theme in it, I was thinking. And the guy's a philosophy professor. I studied philosophy back in the day. And it just occurs to me that there's something about, you know, philosophy of stories, philosophy of narratives, that maybe what you're saying in this is we can tell ourselves a story and move that story around and kind of be who we want if we tell ourselves the right story. And we can change that throughout our lives. But you tell me, you're the director.
Well, these are eternal questions, aren't they? Like,
yeah.
Who are we? How are we? Are we, you know, is identity fixed? Can it change? Can we become different? What makes us who we are? Is that, you know? So, I mean, no one totally figures this out ever, but it's fun to think about. And this whole movie is kind of a think piece on identity. And I think the notion of, can you change? You know,
yeah.
Are we fixed?
Yeah.
And I think it's more optimistic at the end of the day. And this is where my head was at maybe 20 years ago. I would say, no, we got our fixed set points and you do your best within those. But nothing's changing that in general. Mm. But here, I think it was more optimistic to say, you know, you really can. You can kind of become a different person. You know, you really can. And this is based on some studies I'd read. And it's like, no.
Yeah.
And, you know, the movie leaves itself room to actually muse on these things.
Yeah.
And it's interwoven with the theme of the movie. Like Gary yeah. is becoming Ron in a funny way. I mean, it's a comedy, right?
Yeah, but absolutely.
It's also, you see a guy by the end of the movie doing stuff the guy at the beginning would never do, because what he's really done is become passionate.
Yeah.
He's this dispassionate guy at the beginning, all in his head, you know, kind of at a remove from the world, but then he discovers like passion and that kind of commit love and, you know, everything that goes with that. It's very sexual. You know, he puts himself out in the world as this passionate sexual being. And, you know, he has to pay you know, all the trouble that can get one in, you know?
Absolutely. And so, I mean, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole with this, but you've kind of observed that in life yourself as he's grown older, that you've become more positive that we can make substantial changes to who we are. Like, do you believe that as well?
I do. I think so. I want to believe that.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder that about myself a lot, you know, like we all do. We regulate.
Yeah.
Am I as passionate about this as I was? I think I was like, no, you know, if you've really put the years in and thought you deserve some hard won victories when it comes to yourself, you know, it's like, hey, you know, we all have friends who've gone in both directions. We have some people like, God, you just get worse every year. What are your problems? What are you're so bitter. You're so, you know, just like, you see people just kind of like, I don't want to be around you. And then other people who you see them like, just let go of things that used to bother them. And that's the good thing about, you know, working through life. Like you just don't care as much about things that maybe you shouldn't have cared about so much at a certain stage, or it's not worth caring about. And then what do you care about? You know, it opens up to hopefully deeper, richer, but you know, it's a great forum in the movie. He's a college instructor. So he gets to give these lectures that are actually pretty on point thematically to the movie.
Mm.
Even up one of the last ones he gives, second to last, is, you know, it's about even the death penalty. But right before it works into the movie because, you know, what's going to happen at some point. So
yeah,
I use that as a forum for these throw out ideas. And he even says, there's been a lot of research lately that suggests the way academics can kind of go, I read a study. Maybe it's not replicable. Maybe it's not a fact yet, but it's something I'm interested in.
Tell me this. The story was in, you came across in a thing called Texas Monthly. And I know you came across that, or you used that as well for Bernie. And, you know, from the outside looking in, you know, you could be snobby and go, he doesn't go to the New York Times or the San Francisco Chronicle. He goes to the Texas Monthly, which is like something, you know, the Dublin Gazette, where I'm talking to you from, wherever. But it seems to me that maybe that's very much part of who you are. Like you want to find stories everywhere, not just on the East Coast or the West Coast of America.
Yeah. Texas Monthly is a, well, it's kind of what it sounds like. It's a Texas magazine, but it's really, they have excellent writers. It's been around forever. And it is one of the most like awarded magazines for its journalism. So Skip Hollandsworth is a great writer with a real nose for like a true crime story or crazy characters or, you know, some unique atmosphere of weirdness within the Texas borders. So I don't know. I've always read his work and most of that magazine, thumbed through it at least. So I don't know. It seemed like a logical place.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny. I've done two movies based on stories out of there, but.
Yeah. Well, why not? Why not? Absolutely. It sounds like a type of publication they're local. I'd like to read.
I understand the people in these stories. I go, oh, I totally know them. You know,
yeah.
Reminds me of my mom and her friends. Oh, that's like guys I worked with in Houston. Like I feel it, you know, you know, what attracts you to a story to make you think you could make a movie or enough to go through all the labor that's involved in making a movie? It better be something you seem to know. And
talking of labor, and forgive me if you've been asked this a lot. There's a lot of movies of yours I love, Slacker, School of Rock in particular, actually. But I just wonder with Boyhood, the labor of that, when we look back on it now, 11 years. Now, I know you did other things during that, but do you look back and go, God, that was a lot of work? Like, what I presume it was a huge amount of work. I know a bit about how movies are made, the staging of getting these people in different stages of their life. Like, I don't imagine it's something you'd ever want to do again.
No, I don't think of it that way at all. When I look back at Boyhood, I don't think of it as that hard, you know. It was persistent, but, you know, we'd shoot about 3 days a year, which requires a lot of preparation, but it was just, you know, a routine. Making movies is all about process, you know, like so much of life. You just put one foot in front of the other and do what you have to do to make this work. So for this particular story, but it was very pleasant, you know. I mean, every movie has its little problems, and most of movie making is problem solving in some way. Yeah. It's like actor schedules, getting the band together and playing a gig, you know. It was, at the end of the day, it's really joyful, you know. And I want sort of a work play environment, and we were like such a family. So I don't know, it was just kind of fun. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah. See, it's guys like me looking from the outside in, you know, who think these things. But it was a great movie. And as I say, it's my favorite years. Listen, we're out of time, unfortunately, but Hitman is great. It's delightful.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah. So continued success.
It's that sexy thriller. It's kind of a genre I hadn't done. So
yeah. Well, you did it very well.
My old fashioned sexy thriller, I guess.
Yes, something exactly. Like,
okay. Well, great talking.
Nice to meet you. You too. Cheers.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Richard Linklater there talking to me about Hitman, which lands on Netflix on the 7th of June. Really enjoyable movie and great to talk to the great Richard Linklater. That's it for this week. There is no show next week due to the election. So I will be back in 2 weeks' time. Although you can hear me next Friday filling in for Sean Moncrief. So tune into that if you can't bear to go 2 weeks without me. Failing that, I will talk to you in 2 weeks' time. Enjoy the remainder of your long bank holiday weekend, and I'll talk to you all soon.